Here on FM, the Book of the Week. Peter Pomerantsev, raised in England, the son of political exiles, moved to Moscow in 2006 to work as a television producer. In this final episode, he reflects upon the psychological impact of Russia's sudden shift from communism to capitalism, and on whether his career choices leave him morally compromised. Justin Salinger reads, "Nothing is true and everything is possible."
Astankino wants to make me an offer. Would I like to helm a historical drama documentary with a real big mini-movie budget for actors and reconstructions and set designers? The sort of thing you make when you're right at the top of the TV tree in the West and that TNT would never even dream of making. The drama is to be about a Second World War admiral who defied Stalin's orders. It's a really good story. It's the dream project. I need time to decide. At TNT, all the positive stories I touch on seem to tumble into negativity. A bunch of girls from Kiev who call themselves femen and who protest sex tourism by stripping down and running about naked at state events to highlight the sexism of the system sounded perfect for TNT. But suddenly they start protesting against the president. TNT would never touch them now. I am running out of money, and I am considering joining Astankino. For every blatant propaganda show Astankino makes, there's some edgy realist drama, some acerbic comedy. You can laugh and ignore the propaganda and watch the good stuff, and that's what people I know do. Lots of good people make big shows and films for Astankino, and no one holds it against them. You make your own project, keep your hands clean, as everyone here likes to say, and the rest just isn't your concern. It's just a job. That's not you. Growing up, I had never really thought too much about my parents' life in the Soviet Union, why they had emigrated. The USSR was just somewhere people left. But what exactly was it that they were rejecting? I remember a story my mother once told me. She was 15. It was 1971. Their teacher at her ordinary suburban Kiev school announced that today they would receive a very special visitor. He was from Radio Comintern, one of the propaganda elite who broadcast Soviet ideas to the West. The man was in his 30s, and he wore jeans and a leather jacket. Only the coolest, most rebellious, yet best connected, only the best connected could afford to be rebellious, were able to get hold of jeans and leather jackets, which came only from the West, and it was a privilege to go there or even know someone who went there. He sat on the edge of the teacher's desk and smirked that knowing smirk that my mother would later recognise as the mark of the KGB boys, and that I now see on the president and the men around him, the smile of the men who know they can see through everything. The special visitor told the kids how Russia was surrounded by enemies, how they needed to be careful of Western agents and Western influences. He talked about how he had Beatles records at home. My mother had always been scared to even say the word Beatles in public. He told them he'd even been abroad. No one in my mother's school had ever been abroad. In 1968, he had been in Prague, part of the Soviet forces that had liberated Czechoslovakia from counter-revolution. He told the kids about how they would go drinking in the cafes of the old town. My mother tried to imagine cafes in the old town, but struggled to form a picture in her mind. And he told them how one time, when he was sitting in a cafe, some Czechs ran in and started shouting, "Russians go home! Russians go home!" This struck my mother. She had always believed the stuff about the Soviet Union liberating Czechoslovakia. She believed the Soviet Union stood for global social justice. "You mean they weren't happy to see you?" she asked. He looked at her like she was an idiot. Everyone who grew up in the Soviet Union had a moment when they woke up. That was my mother's. And as she began to look at the world around her, she slowly saw how everyone was pretending, was faking belief, being one thing in the morning and another in the afternoon, but scared too, fear and irony together, and so many voices at the same time. One you in the morning at the Komsomol, the Communist Youth League, another you in the afternoon reading Solzhenitsyn, one you at work being a good socialist, and another listening to the BBC in secret in your kitchen, yet everyone knowing you listened, because they were all listening themselves. Whenever I ask my Russian bosses, the older TV producers and media types who run the system, what it was like growing up in the late Soviet Union, whether they believed in the communist ideology that surrounded them, they always laugh at me. "Don't be silly," most answer. "So you were dissidents? You believed in finishing the USSR?" "No, it's not like that. You just speak several languages at the same time, all the time. There's like several yous." Seen from this perspective, the great drama of Russia is not the transition between communism and capitalism, between one fervently held set of beliefs and another, but that during the final decades of the USSR, no one believed in communism and yet carried on living as if they did. And now they can only create a society of simulations. For this remains the common, everyday psychology. All cultures have differences between public and private selves, but in Russia, the contradiction can be quite extreme. At some point in the 1970s, during her late teens, my mother had lain down on a bed and thought she was losing her mind. All those people she was meant to be, without any centre. She could feel herself splitting up into little bits. Then began her journey to find the small bands of Soviet dissidents. They had their own vocabulary. They talked about porядochnost, decency, which in practice could mean not being an informant, about dostoinstvo, dignity, which in practice could mean not making films or writing books or saying things the Kremlin wanted but you hated. And for many in the 1970s, the only way out was prison or emigration. And sometimes it still is. I have told the people at Ostankino I won't take up their offer. I just need to leave. I need to go back to London, where you don't have to split yourself up into little bits. London. 2011. Chancery Lane. The Court of the Rolls. This is the largest private litigation in history. Boris Berezovsky, the godfather of the Kremlin, the original oligarch, the man who created the Russian system and moulded the president, before being exiled by his own creation and fleeing to London, versus his protege, Roman Abramovich, the stealth oligarch, who outgrew the old master to become one of the president's new favourites, and who has also moved to London, though not to seek asylum, but to become one of the UK's richest men. A timid, unshaven, baggy-suited herald of the 21st century Russia that buys up sports clubs, castles, German ex-chancellors and newspapers. The case concerns Sibneft, an oil company. It was privatised for £60 million in 1996 and by 2005 was worth £8 billion. Berezovsky claims Abramovich and he were co-owners until Abramovich acted like a gangster and took Berezovsky's share away. Abramovich, bottle of cold water pressed to his temple against a headache, explains that Berezovsky was the gangster, the political godfather he would have to pay extortion money to when Berezovsky was vizier in the 1990s Kremlin. But as soon as Berezovsky lost his influence, he lost his access to money. Thus the president and his network find it so hard to leave the Kremlin now. The minute he retires, they might lose everything. There are no Western-style property rights in this system, only gradations of proximity to the Kremlin, rituals of bribes and toadying, casual violence. And as I observe the trial from my cramped corner among the public seats, it takes on a dimly epic feel. Not just a squabble between two men, but a judgment on the era. "I was the first victim of President Putin's regime," pleads Berezovsky, "and then step by step he increased the number of victims." And with a rising passion, he reels off the names of all the jailed businessmen and women, murdered journalists and dead lawyers. If Russia in the 1990s was corrupt on a scale of 4 out of 10, argues Berezovsky, now it is corrupt 10 out of 10. It is corrupt totally. And yet it was Berezovsky who introduced the fabricated documentary to Astankino, inventing barely credible scandals about the then president's political opponents. In 1999, it was Berezovsky's TV channel that created the new president, supporting his war in Chechnya and turning him from grey moth into macho leader. Russia's slide from representative democracy to a society of pure spectacle was given its great push by Berezovsky. He created the theatre I would later work inside. I found Mr. Berezovsky an unimpressive and inherently unreliable witness who regarded truth as a transitory, flexible concept which could be moulded to suit his current purposes, says Mrs. Justice Gloucester in her final judgment. I gained the impression that he was not necessarily being deliberately dishonest, but had deluded himself into believing his own version of events. 6 months later, Berezovsky was dead, committing suicide in the bathroom of his ex-wife's Ascot mansion. I had assumed that Astankino channels would gloat. Instead, the atmosphere is mournful. An Astankino channel shows black and white photos of Berezovsky as touching mood music is played. But though the old master may be dead, the system he begat is growing, mutating, swelling now out of Moscow and flowing through many offshore tax-free beneficiary-disguised archipelagos in Cyprus, the British Virgin Islands and Monaco, and from there into Mayfair, Belgravia, Sloane Street, Whitehall, Central Park West. For the president's men and those who fear him, for the bully bureaucrats and the gangsters-turned-oil traders, for the real entrepreneurs and the Russians who just want to get out and live a normal life. For everyone, the pattern is the same. Make, steal, siphon your money off in Russia, stash it in New York, Paris, Geneva, and especially London. I am at the airport, getting ready to catch the Moscow flight. My daughter is with me. Her mother, my wife, is a Muscovite. We met during the almost decade I spent in Russia. My daughter was born while I still worked there. Now we all live together in London. When I travel to Russia, it is less often on TV projects and more frequently as a father. I don't travel with a camera anymore. I find I do fewer of those sorts of TV projects, the ones where you push your way into people's lives, try to get as close to things as possible. For all our claims to capture the real, a factual director is always a manipulator. And when we begin to edit, our subject's video representation takes on a life of its own, a hologram cross-faded, saturated, flipped, squeezed, and cut in different ways for US, UK, internet and promotional edits. Those holograms we have created then pursue us. The emotions our subjects once poured out to us stay with us. And we begin to live in a parallel reality of video ghosts, the gold diggers, the gangsters, everyone I've ever filmed. They visit me from time to time. Come back, my wife exclaims when she sees me with that distracted look. Look at your daughter, the real world. We're here.
Justin Salinger was reading Nothing is True and Everything is Possible by Peter Pomerantsev. The book was abridged by Robin Brooks and produced by Kirsteen Cameron. In Woman's Hour, after the news, abortion law in Northern Ireland, how Manet changed the depiction of women in art, giving up the booze and encouraging Muslim girls into university.
I'm middle class, and notice that slight hesitation, which I hear a lot. Is it because we don't really like to admit it, or because we know deep down that we're in decline? Because I think we are. It isn't a tale of desperate poverty, but it's an important story, and as Francis Fukuyama says in the programme, it may turn out to be important for everybody. Join me, David Boyle, here on BBC Radio 4 to hear more in Clinging On, The Decline of the Middle Classes, on Tuesday evening at 8 o'clock.